So it's a hemisphere church right now, a world church. Furthermore, that in most of the populated, most populous areas of the earth, the church is not growing or even getting access. We're not getting into China. We might someday. I mean, I suppose 10 years ago, nobody would have expected us to get into Russia either. So anything can happen. Even greater obstacle for a large segment of the population of the earth is Islam. It is illegal in almost every Islamic country for other religions to exist. And foreigners are permitted to have furtive meetings in their homes or something of that kind. But the punishments are severe in some of these countries for natives to participate or even investigate other religions. So a lot of things have to happen before there's any real access for us in large parts of the world. In countries that are the traditional sources of converts, which is to say Western Hemisphere and Europe, we can, I think, continue to look forward to steady growth in this hemisphere. But in Europe, going is very rough indeed. There is perhaps in all of Europe, including England, there are probably not 300,000 members of the church. Half of those, or slightly more than half, are in England itself, or the British Isles. So that means that something like 100,000, maybe 120,000 members in all the rest of the continent of Europe. That's just a dusting across the top. And the prospects in Europe right now are not good. Nothing like they are in Latin America. So we have some really great things to rejoice in if we wish the church well, as I hope you realize I do. But we cannot be terribly sanguine about the future prospects in some places. Furthermore, it is not only our church that is experiencing rapid growth in places like Latin America. Actually, the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Pentecostals are beating us out. They're all doing at least as well as we are in Latin America. So we have a lot of competition there. Another thing that's worth observing is that while the growth of the church has been very rapid since World War II, there are signs that growth is slowing down and leveling off in the 1990s. The 1990s aren't out yet, so we won't be able to make a very good estimate for how it's going to end up in the by the end of the decade. But so far, the growth has leveled off. In particular, not just the growth in membership, but growth in the rate at which new stakes are created has slowed down a great deal in the last 5 or 6 years. The principal reason for this seems to be the difficulty we have in retaining enough men holding the Melchizedek priesthood to be able to create new stakes. That's the principal deterrent to the creation of new stakes. So we are not, during the last 5 or 6 years, we are not creating new stakes at anything near the rate that we did the previous decade or decades. And even the sheer membership growth rate of the church has slowed. Now, whether that will continue to be the case, I don't think anybody can say right now. It might just be a blip on the screen, a temporary stall, or it might portend a longer trend. So we'll have to wait and see about that. Another datum that I think is important here is that in almost every country, the conversion of women runs at about double the rate the conversion of men. And unless we reinstitute polygamy, this creates problems of its own. What typically happens, of course, is that if those convert sisters marry, they are more likely to marry non-members than to marry members. Now, that's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, that might make for the conversion of the non-member spouse after their marriage. And of course, that happens. It happens much less commonly outside of North America than it does in North America, however. Almost always, that would be an exaggeration, but in the majority of cases, outside of North America, especially sisters who do not marry members of the church, are more likely to find their own church activity suffering than finding that they have converted their spouses. So it's a problem that we don't have demographic balance in the conversion process. Another thing that I think is important in trying to assess what we mean by a world church is that we have only just arrived at the point where we're beginning to get a sizable second generation outside of North America. Of course, we know that inside North America we have 4, 5, 6 generation Mormons. That's not the case in any other country or any other part of the world outside of North America. We, of course, have had missionaries and converts in many countries for a long time, but the constant emigration out of those countries to North America has continued to keep, even since World War II, has continued to keep the rate low at which a second generation grows. So when you realize that something like 90% of all of the members of, or all of the converts to the church have been converted since about 1960, you see that there hasn't been time yet for many of them to have children grow up in the church. And some have. Here and there we have larger numbers of second generation than in other places. But it's right now very iffy. I think an enormous question for the future is how well the church will succeed in holding on to second and third generations outside of North America. The critical mass, spiritually and intellectually, that makes that possible is just not there in very many other places. We sometimes tend to forget that our experience in North America is not only different because we're Americans, but it's different because the church had 2 or more generations of isolation in Utah and the Mountain West in which to create a critical mass and build strong testimonies and commitments to the church before people in my generation started migrating back out of the heartland and into other places. They don't have that in Europe and Asia and other places. So this is a problem. It's also important to keep in mind a few important things about the current missionary system and the way that system works. We've had a lot of iterations of the missionary system, as you know. Anybody who's kept track of things in the last 50 years, as I have, I'm just realizing that I'm coming up to within months of the 50th anniversary of my departure on my mission, which is a sobering realization. Anybody who's kept track of that knows that there's been this plan and that plan and a number of other plans. There are a few things that I think are especially interesting and important about the present system. First of all, you will either be delighted or distressed or have mixed feelings to know that the current missionary system is informed in large part by a very thorough social science research. One hopes that, and one has, of course, fundamental faith that in the final analysis, when key policy decisions are made and other things occur that are crucial, that there is a large spiritual and prophetic element in the decisions about what to choose from the facts and the data that we know. But to get the facts and the data from which these decisions have to be made, the church maintains a large social science research organization on the 18th floor in the big white high-rise in Salt Lake City. It's called the Research Information Division. It consists of a couple of dozen very dangerous people That is, they're dangerous in the sense that they are PhDs in psychology and sociology who are among the most dangerous people on the face of the earth. And they are in constant contact with the priesthood leaders of the church, who are constantly asking them for information, constantly negotiating with them research projects that need to be done to find out this or that or something else about the nature of membership of the church. And a few years ago, about a decade ago or a little more, one of the projects that was launched was a project to uncover the chief social determinants of the conversion process. What is there about the social characteristics of investigators, of missionaries, of ward members, local priesthood leaders, mission presidents? What is there about the characteristics of those kinds of people that maximize the likelihood that a given investigator will join the church, or minimize the likelihood? This was an extensive project, one of the most sophisticated research projects I've ever seen, in which investigators at different stages of the conversion process were actually monitored as they went through, periodically interviewed by researchers who, in effect, looked over the shoulders of the missionaries, actually were present for missionary lessons and this kind of thing. And the result was an enormously informative framework for understanding the conversion process. And that understanding has greatly informed the present missionary system. One of the things that was learned from that project is not only that in a given region, as you might expect, the conversion rate is determined mainly by the sheer number of missionaries that you have, which shouldn't surprise anybody, although we do sometimes think that that if you only, even if you only have a few missionaries, if they work really hard and if there's a spiritual environment and things are right, or the people are poor enough or miserable enough or whatever, that you get these enormous rates of conversion. But after all is said and done, what you get down to is the sheer number of missionaries. But beyond that, what we learned was that one of the things we learned was that the relationship with the missionary turns out to override almost anything else in the conversion process. Now, we didn't used to take that fact into account much in our missionary training. They'd get training in the scriptures and in memorizing the lessons. They don't memorize those anymore, but they'd be trained in memorizing the lessons, especially in their language, in foreign languages. But there was a sense that if the system was applied in a uniform and standardized way, the way it had been designed, that you'd get the yield, no matter who the missionary was. Well, it turns out that it's much more important than we ever thought that missionaries be trained in interpersonal relationships and interpersonal communication. That turned out to be a much bigger factor than anybody thought when the research began. Also, training in pedagogical skill. It's not, of course, just a matter of putting out a canned lesson and waiting until you get the right answer from Brother Brown, Mr. Brown, or even badgering him until you get it. There has to be a systematic and kind of logical process by which you get one point established and then you move on to the next. And there are ways to do that with great skill, Socratic ways to do that, that do not involve the kind of condescension that some of the earlier memorized systems did. So missionary skills in pedagogy and in interpersonal relations are the things that have loomed especially large. We've also learned that while the scriptures assure us that the field is white and ready to harvest, it's a lot whiter in some places than in others. And I don't mean any pun by that. I mean I'm using the metaphor here of the white-headed wheat. That is to say, there's an enormous variation from one not only from one region of the world to another in the readiness that people have for receiving the LDS message, but even in countries that are ostensibly very similar in the same region, there is an enormous variation. One of the things that we've tried to do is understand what makes for those differences. I'm going to come back to that point a little bit later. At this point, I just want to establish the basic understanding of how much variation there is in places that look like they ought to be similar in receptivity to the church message, but they turn out to be very, very different. In view of all of this, the general LDS philosophy of missionizing in the last few decades, especially in the last perhaps two decades, has been to a kind of skimming approach. That is, going into a population and a kind of a blitz approach, getting contact with people who will let you talk, who will let you in, giving them a really thorough and heavy treatment, thorough and heavy in a relative sense, that is, in the time provided, but ultimately not a very deep proselyting experience, a fairly superficial one. That's why I call it skimming. This helps to identify, or as it were, flesh out a large number of people who seem to be, number one, available, number two, willing to engage the missionaries, and number three, who have relatively little to lose by investigating a new religion. And our conversions have taken place in large part among people with those characteristics, which has involved sometimes rather hasty baptisms, and you may grouse, as I have found myself doing from time to time as a local ward leader. I found myself grousing from time to time about, you know, why did that person ever get baptized? Why in the world? You know, obviously this person was not ready. That's the current way, folks. If they'll accept baptism, you baptize them. And then it's up to the rest of the membership of the church to finish the conversion process. And this same kind of research that I mentioned the church has done earlier has included a phase in which the new members, a sample of new members, are followed up for a year after their baptism to see what happens to them and to see what makes a difference in the retention a year later and the non-retention. And in this, of course, it will not surprise anybody to know that the crucial thing is how rapidly and how densely that new convert can be brought to form social relationships with the other members of the ward. If those social relationships get established early and are maintained, that person is retained as a member of the church a year later. Otherwise, he or she is out the door in a matter of weeks. It's not just that, you know, that they get the follow-up lessons or go faithfully to the Gospel Essentials class. It's those things will all help. But the crucial thing is forming bonds, social bonds with other members of the church. They don't do that, it doesn't happen. Now, you may think, and we would like to think, that a crucial thing is here, how much do they know about the gospel? That turns out to be a relatively unimportant issue in their retention, even in their baptism, which is a startling discovery for many Latter-day Saints. And one of the things that the researchers found out in this process is they would interview people right after baptism to see how much they knew. And they would ask them such things as, well, did you read the Book of Mormon before you were baptized? Oh, yes, I read the Book of Mormon. Well, I'd like to ask you a couple questions about it, see what you think about it. Now, do you remember reading about a person named Mormon? Yeah. Do you remember if Mormon had any children? Can you think of the name of, say, one of the sons of Mormon? The rate at which people could answer that was abysmally low. They just didn't know. There were a lot of other things that you would think a person would know, even from a fairly rapid reading of the Book of Mormon, which these people didn't know. And while they were generally able to give back to the interviewers most of the basic ideas of the missionary lessons, the basic gospel principles, there was no depth there, and there was really quite a bit of misunderstanding. So they, on the whole, have not come into the church with much understanding of the gospel or the scriptures. But they come into the church with a strong feeling that they want to. The chief function of the Book of Mormon, or the chief functions of the Book of Mormon in the teaching process, seem to include at least these two. One, that by inducing converts to read the Book of Mormon, by getting commitments from them to read the Book of Mormon, the missionaries are inducing them to participate actively in their own conversion. And that's a crucial thing. We tend to think of conversion as an event that happens, when in fact it's not an event but a process. And we tend to think of conversion as something that somebody does to somebody else. Even if we say it's the Spirit of the Lord that's doing it, it's something somebody does to somebody else. That doesn't seem to be the way it works either. Conversion process, at least a conversion process that sticks, is one in which the convert is actively participating in his or her own conversion. And one of the ways that they do that is to read the Book of Mormon. One of the ways they do that is to come out to church, to even in the missionary discussions take part by reading the scriptures that the missionaries ask them to read. All of these forms of participation enhance the conversion process. Now this has to continue after baptism, and if it doesn't, then their conversion to the church is not very very long lived. I said a minute ago there are a couple of things that the Book of Mormon does in the conversion process. And so with a little digression, I emphasize that one of these is that by reading the Book of Mormon, they participate in their own conversion. The second thing it does is that for many people who read the Book of Mormon, there is a profound spiritual experience. Now, social scientists would probably call it an emotional experience, rather than a spiritual experience, but whatever that experience is, many people who read the Book of Mormon enjoy a really great feeling while they're reading it, and have a great feeling after they've finished reading it. And the missionaries know that, and the missionaries are taught that when they see signs of that, they're supposed to point out to the prospective convert that what that person is feeling is the ministrations of the Spirit of the Lord, and to bear testimony to that effect. But if you think of the function of the Book of Mormon as teaching them any kind of substantive gospel knowledge, that happens maybe, we hope, later after they join the church. But it doesn't happen much before they join the church. That isn't the way the Book of Mormon works in the conversion process. So these are some of the things that we've learned. If you and I sometimes have the feeling that people are being baptized prematurely, then you should know that this is not a fluke. This is by deliberate missionary policy of the church. I don't mean that the missionary policy of the church deliberately encourages superficial conversion. I mean that the missionary policy of the church deliberately encourages rapid conversion or rapid baptisms with the full understanding that the knowledge that a person has at the time of baptism is going to be very superficial. That's known and understood by the presiding brethren. That's a deliberate decision made to skim the people, skim off the top, as it were, the people who are part of this white, ready-to-harvest population, and not linger too long with those that that dig in their heels and don't yield very quickly. And then the part of that same policy is that after the baptism, it's up to the rest of the members of the church to see that the conversion process is completed. And so when you get what seem to be baptisms that are premature, it's not an accident. This is the policy of the church. And to the extent that it works because the saints in the wards are doing their job in the fellowshipping process. And if it doesn't work, that's because they're not doing that. So this failure on the part of most Latter-day Saints all over the world to do a good job of fellowshipping is the principal reason, given the policy I stated. That failure of fellowshipping is the principal reason that we have such a large dropout rate. And we do. The dropout rate ranges, say, if you take as a point the year after baptism, the dropout rate ranges from 30% to 70% of the membership of the church. It's closer to 30% in North America. It's closer to 70% in Japan, Europe, and places like that. So there is a big dropout rate, and it seems to be attributable to failure of fellowshipping. I think it should be observed, however, that there have also been some excesses in the implementation of the, you know, rapid baptism philosophy. You have all heard of the baseball baptisms in England in the 60s, but that's not the only place it happened. Similar things happened as recently as the 1980s in Australia, as recently as the late 70s and early 80s in Japan. So it's been, these excesses, as I call them, were not part of the policy, but were a result of the attempt of a particular mission president to raise the baptism rate in the mission. So those are some of the basic realities, quantitative realities, and policy realities that we see. Now, I think most of us would be able to imagine both some upsides and some downsides of these developments. I think what I'd like to do next is just raise a few issues that we face in the church that will have to be resolved if the growth of the church is going to continue at the rather rapid rate that it has so far. And if you want, again, a lot more information, be sure to get your latest dialogue either by subscription or in the book exhibit next door, where many of these basic ideas that I'm laying out are explored in detail and supported with a great deal of additional information. Okay, I'm going to continue to use a tone here that is a social science-y tone, that is a secular tone. And I want to acknowledge at the outset that I don't believe, and I don't think many LDS social scientists anyway believe, that everything that we need to understand about the conversion and retention of members is to be explained in sociological or psychological terms. I think even non-LDS sociologists and social scientists recognize that there are a great many unpredictable, uncontrollable factors that enter in. You can either think of these other factors in strictly gospel terms as spiritual factors that depend upon divine influences, or you can think of the term spiritual as a kind of residual category. That is, if you can't explain what happens any other way, you call it spiritual. Whatever your want is on this will be up to you. But I don't mean to suggest, and even though I'm taking, as I say, a very secular tone in this, I don't mean to suggest that the secular explanation is all there is. It may not even be most of it. But among the things that have to be resolved in the future, if the church is to prosper, are, one, how do we deal with a variety of political and social climates that exist around the earth? These take many forms. One fundamental question is whether or not in a given country there is truly an open market for different religions. We are so used to the North American situation where, you know, almost anybody can start a church on almost any grounds, on almost any claim, and also a situation in which a person's church membership or lack of it in this country has almost no implications for any other part of life. It doesn't affect your job, typically. It doesn't affect your political choices. It doesn't affect... You can, with most Americans, though there is an anti-Mormon element, and by the way, Gordon Melton, in a later session, will be talking about the anti-Mormon crusade in Europe, which I think would be a very interesting kind of follow-on to some of the things I'm saying here. There is an anti-Mormon element in most, certainly in a lot in Europe and America, and maybe in other places as well. But it is not large. What really matters more is whether the country as a whole has this kind of what I might call open market approach to other religions. We're used to that in North America. We can't take it for granted very many other places. It has come to be more the case in Europe than it once was, but it is still far from the case in Europe, and to say nothing of other societies. Now, it's not only an open market in the political sense that the Constitution or the law of a given country allows people to have any religion they want. It's also a cultural thing. We are, again, in North America, so used to seeing religion, a particular denomination, as kind of irrelevant to one's Americanism, that we fail to realize that in, France or Germany, there's a sense in which if one becomes a Mormon, that person is less French or less German, because the traditional religions of those countries have so interpenetrated the culture and the social organization that a person is, in effect, pulling himself out of this enormous traditional network. We don't experience that much in North America. A lot of people have written about the fundamental so-called civil religion that ties us all together in America, a religion kind of Americanism. And there's that marvelous comment from Dwight Eisenhower while he was president in the 1950s that Americanism involves, you know, church membership or belief in God, no matter what God or what church, just so, you know, there is one. It's not that simple in most of the other countries of the earth. So anybody who has done missionary work in some of these other countries knows that one of the great obstacles is that we're asking people who join this church not only to join an organization that has about the same image in France that the Moonies have here. You need to understand that. We are a weird cult everywhere else but North America. We're not only asking people to do that, we are asking them to pull themselves out of a social and cultural network and heritage that has been crucial to their lives and has been especially nourishing to their lives. In much of Europe, there is a process that some social scientists there have called pillarization, about which a couple of the authors in this issue write with great poignancy. In much of Northwestern Europe, for example, you are either a Catholic or a Lutheran or perhaps a Calvinist of some kind by birth, or Church of England in England. Depending on which of those faiths you're born into, you're born in a hospital that belongs to that faith, ministered to by doctors who are out of that faith. You then go to a school that is a Catholic, Lutheran, or Calvinist school. You, if you need help with employment, you go to an employment office that is faith or denominationally connected. If you need social welfare services, if you want to adopt a baby, if you get sick and have to go to the hospital, and finally when you get buried in the cemetery, you are being, in large part, you will be ministered to by agencies that have a direct connection and indeed are under the supervision of denominations. Now, the reason this is possible is because in most of these places, historically, and to some extent even now, these have been state churches, which receive tax revenue, and the tax revenue, in effect, then goes back to them in order to conduct these various kinds of social exercises or social activities. This has been referred to sometimes as pillarization, with the image here that you have a Catholic pillar and a Lutheran pillar or some other pillar, and in that pillar your whole life takes place, you know, from birth to death. And the relationships between pillars are very civil and all of that, and that the level of government, great effort is made not to favor one over the other, but still there is that pillarization. Now, you know, what if you come out of a Catholic pillar and you become a Mormon? Your access to these services becomes immediately problematic. And in some cases, while the law might not permit you to be deprived as a Mormon convert of certain life and death services like hospital, let's say, I don't want to exaggerate this too much, you will find it very hard as a Mormon convert to adopt a child in one of those countries. You will find not very much enthusiasm with employment agencies to help you find a job if it's known that you're a Mormon convert. We can't imagine this in North America, but this is the kind of thing that I think has to be included when we talk about whether, in fact, there is an open market. Politically, constitutionally open market is one thing. Organically open is something else again, and we don't find that very many places. Another issue of this larger category of which I'm dealing with now, of how the church handles local social and political climates, is relationships with the United States. I find it useful to think of an analogy in which the relationship of Mormonism to the United States is similar to the relationship of Christianity to the Roman Empire. In the ancient times, where Roman influence went, Christianity went. Where Roman influence stayed, Christianity stayed. I mean, after the Constantine period, at least. It's more complicated than that in the contemporary situation with the United States, but in some parts of the world, Americans and things American are highly prized, and other places they're scorned. And in fact, in the same country, they may be highly prized in one generation and scorned in the next generation. I well remember my 4.5 years in Japan back in the 50s, in which, and this was within a couple of years after the World War II ended, and everything American was great. I mean, everybody wanted to know English, they all wanted to drink Coca-Cola, they wanted to know all about things American, and an American religion, that was neat. So, our missionaries just went great guns offering English classes to get converts, or not converts, to get investigators and contacts, I mean, and then asking people to join, especially young people who were kind of adventurous and looking to the future, asking them to take seriously this weird American religion was a believable thing to ask in those days. And so we got a lot of converts. When there was a lot of enthusiasm in Japan for things American, because we were perceived as an American religion, kind of an American product, just another thing like Coca-Cola, you know, to embrace. That's not true in Japan anymore. It hasn't been true for a long time. The same is true in a number of other countries of Europe. And as you've heard, in Latin America, it's a very dicey situation. There are some countries in which the lives of our missionaries are in jeopardy, and other situations where even in Latin America, where it's still pretty good to be, Yankee connected. I gather from first-hand accounts I get out of Brazil that relationships between America and Brazil are very good, and Brazilians still look favorably on things American, and so it's probably not a surprise that the missionary work is going gangbusters in Brazil. In certain other places, like Colombia or Bolivia, things are not going as well. So that's the kind of relationship that exists between the United States and other countries is an important factor here. Let's see. There are a lot of local local issues too that that the LDS Church can get caught up with inadvertently. One of the essays in this collection deals with New Zealand, and in New Zealand has had some certain parallel struggles with their native-born or native indigenous populations that we've had in the United States. And of course down there we're talking about Maoris. Only there are a lot more Maoris as a percentage of New Zealand population than our American Indians as a percentage of our population. Now, the New Zealand government has gone through, in its relationship with the Maori populations, has gone through certain periods in which the government's policy was very assimilationist. You know, you're all going to become English. You're going to speak English. You're going to give up these uncivilized Maori customs, and you're going to, you know, it's okay to be darker in color, but you've got to think English. And that didn't go over too well, and didn't work too well, and it was strongly resisted by what turns out to be a really large percentage of the population. So then, later on, in more recent years, the government of New Zealand has taken a much more multicultural policy, in which not only Maori customs are tolerated, but really celebrated and encouraged under certain circumstances. Some of the kinds of ways that that we've seen efforts here in Canada and the United States to do the same. Now, the trouble is that when our missionaries have gone down there and American mission presidents have gone down there, they have tended so far with church policy to zig when the government policy has zagged, and vice versa, so that we have sometimes found ourselves this essay by Ian Barber makes clear that one of the things that happened was that by the 1980s, the New Zealand government had adopted a pluralistic, multicultural as opposed to assimilationist policy, but the church had, for some years before that, had an assimilationist policy. That is, we're all going to become English-speaking Mormons in New Zealand. But once the government changed its policy, then the LDS policy was not in line with what you might call the environmental press and policy situation in New Zealand, and it really stuck out like a sore thumb. More recently, the church has finally come around to this same kind of multiculturalism, trying to make room for it in the church. One of the big problems seems to be that in New Zealand they have funerary customs that that Utah Mormons find distasteful. And while there doesn't seem to be any gospel principle at stake here, some of the mission presidents have tried to stamp these out. Anyway, Barber goes into this. And so, you know, you can look at New Zealand and its multicultural thing. You can look at the Philippines, where for a long time the missionary work has been very successful among a people who are really looking for a meaningful structure in their lives and a leg up economically after a long period of Marcosism. Not Marxism, but Marcosism. And you notice that in Japan, it's really hard to get people to understand the gospel message. But in Korea, where maybe a third of the population has been Christian already for a long time, you have a much easier time. Now, you'd think that Japan and Korea right next to each other, you know, they're all rukarai to us round eyes. And so that if you do well in one, you ought to do well in the other. Well, they turn out to be very different climates, very different environments for Christians. And remember, one of the things that we've learned is that our missionary work is most successful among people who have already made some kind of cultural break with their own traditions. So if they're already Christians, we have a much better chance of making Mormons out of them than if we have to go right back to the root Buddhism with which they start. And of course, you can see that that's very distasteful to other Christian religions to see us as raiding their flocks, which we are. We have the best of intentions in doing so, but it's still it's what we're doing. The reason, one of the reasons that we succeed as well as we do among young people, among single people, among people who are not highly professionally educated and deep into their careers, is because those people have much less at stake if they make a break and become a Mormon than people who are middle-aged professionals with families. And this is true in Japan, Korea, and a number of other places. There's a concept that might be called, social availability. And that includes some of these factors I've talked about. But in Japan, it is really difficult, much more difficult than in Korea, to get over such notions as sin, which the Japanese don't understand as an abstract concept, and they have a hard time with things like atonement, because to the Japanese, what matters is whether you've given offense to somebody. And if you haven't given offense to somebody, then nothing has happened. There is no sin involved and no atonement necessary. And if there's going to be an atonement, it can't be done by somebody else anyway. It's got to be done by the offender or by his family through certain time-honored methods with long knives or something like that. And in Japan, as in much of Asia, the notion that there's one true church is just inconceivable. If one religion is good, two religions is better. The more religions you have, the better off you are. So a lot of these things make a lot of local differences. We've got to look at things like what fundamental principles of the gospel cannot be compromised in our attempt to work with other cultures. We don't have a clear idea of this yet. We're still struggling with this. I advocate, and others do too, something that might be called Mormon minimalism. That is, we need to decide what five or six or seven basic gospel doctrines have to be understood in generally the same way by all of the people who become Latter-day Saints in all parts of the earth, and leave the rest of the stuff alone, let people stylize it with their own cultures the way we've done. We sometimes criticize Japanese members, for example, who like to kind of keep, sometimes even after they join the church, they'll go to a Buddhist temple to participate in some family ritual, or they might even keep a little Shinto shrine in their homes. Just more out of tradition than anything else. They don't really think they're praying to somebody exactly once they come to be Christians or Latter-day Saints. But we call that superstition, and we say you can't do that. And they say, well, have you Westerners ever taken a long look at where Christmas came from? And what is this business about? We have to have a Halloween party in the middle of the week in our young women's or young men's or primary. Where did that come from? We have to let other people have their superstitions if we have ours. And that's kind of hard to get over to a lot of people who haven't got a lot of experience in other cultures. So we have to decide what we can let go of as really representing American or Utah culture, and what we can't let go of. And this is a real issue that is only in the process of being resolved. We have to decide what's going to be the right mix in places like Japan of integrated centralized correlation on the one hand and local autonomy for leaders on the other. That's been a big problem in a number of places. We have to identify some new proselyting techniques. One of the things that we've learned is that the time-honored process of tracting systematically overlooks certain kinds of people who are not home during the day, who live fairly isolated lives in high-crime areas behind electronically operated gates in their apartments, people who might be interested in this new religion if we could get to them, but we can't. How do we get to people that are systematically overlooked by methods like tracking? Well, a term that occurs to me that we might begin to use is cyber tracking. What we need is a Mormon website where people can call up, you know, and plug in and throw up a menu there and see what they want to learn about. There can be a segment on Mormon history, on Mormon doctrine. There can be a segment on, you know, different cultural things, whatever they want to hear. And, of course, there can be an 800 number that they can call for more information or whatever that number would be in other countries. Might even get a free tabernacle choir rendition as part of this. I'm only being partially facetious in this because I really think that sort of imaginative approach is what we're going to have to use if we're going to get at different kinds of people from the ones that we've traditionally gotten. Now, I think, unaccustomed as I am to brevity, I've pretty much blown the time, and I don't know how much, if any, time we have left. Is there... This is
15 minutes till the next session.
Okay, it's 15 minutes to the next section. It wouldn't be fair, I guess, to take all of that, but I'd welcome any input from you, either about your own experiences or questions that you might have. Yes?
Please comment further on the growth and acceptance of the church in the former Soviet Union.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. In the former Soviet, in Russia, and in the former Soviet bloc countries, Hungary, Poland, other places, what we saw in the church during about the first 5 years after Gorbachev was a mushrooming of interest in the church. Hundreds, thousands of converts brought in these places. New branches formed. At this point, that tide has receded drastically, almost to a ripple. And it's not just true of the Latter-day Saints. Many of the other denominations are experiencing the same thing. An initial enthusiasm, kind of in the same way that I mentioned that was in the 50s in Japan. You know, after Gorbachev, things Western, these are in, including new Western religions. Well, now there's a disillusionment with some of that. And just as our missionary efforts benefited by this initial enthusiasm, they are now being hurt by the disillusionment. And it's just not taking so well anymore. One of the reasons it's not is because the influx of these new religions scared the bejabbers out of the Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox denominations, and they have been undergoing a revival. They've been fighting back, both by trying to refurbish their own spiritual heritage, which had kind of fallen into some disuse under their former governments, but also, since they are still in certain ways in cahoots with their governments, they are pressuring their governments to do something about these Mormons and Pentecostals and Jehovah's Witnesses and all these other weird cults and troublemakers. So that's kind of a quick thumbnail sketch of what we've been experiencing in those countries. Yes, sister?
I feel that has been any addressing that issue.
Well, it continues to be a problem. A student of mine at Washington State University was a missionary to France at one point and did a doctoral dissertation on some of these same things. And, you know, one of the startling things that he observed was that a man and wife joined the church in France, and within a year he was made the branch president. And when a certain point in time came in the summer, he announced that in time-honored fashion, as his family has always done, they were going to spend the next month of their vacation at a nudist colony. And he'd always done that. A tremendous brouhaha ensued, of course, instigated by the American missionaries, who thought this was no way for a branch president to behave. Well, they finally backed off and went, you know, on a mountain camping or something, because when they saw all the trouble that had been made, but they were astonished. They couldn't imagine why Americans would have such hang-ups about nudity. I think that kind of illustrates the problem that you're dealing with. We don't have a solution to that. We still have only the most basic church magazines and manuals translated into these other languages. One of the essays in here by Wilfried de Kooh is just full of anguish about, you know, we can't get any books. And we get resistance when we try to translate them, and general authorities will come over and tell us that we shouldn't worry about it. All we need is the scriptures. He tells about one case in which he heard a sermon like that and walked out in the foyer and saw this general authority's wife and children out there reading novels by Jack Leyland, reading Nibley stuff, and even they had not found it enough. So your problem is a good one, and we don't have an answer for it. Yeah. Well, I don't know that I have a very strong grasp of the facts about the early days of the church. I'm not even sure about my grasp of the facts in today's church. But I don't know, my sense from the diaries I've read, from the years I spent myself as a missionary half a century ago in the New England states, those are not early. Well, we replicated the early days because Uncle Dilworth Young made us go without Purser Script through the countryside. But my impression from those sources is that it took a lot longer to get people into the church in those days, but they were more likely to stay. But I'm not so sure they were more likely to stay because it took longer to get them into the church. I think they were more likely to stay because as soon as they joined, they bugged out for Utah. And where they had, and this is a crucial, understand this, I think, especially when we think about the mass conversions in England in the 1830s and 40s. Here were people who, I don't want to minimize either the power of the Holy Spirit or the power of people like Wilford Woodruff, but the fact remains is these were people who, by and large, had very little to lose by getting out of England to America and getting out of the old religion into a new religion. And when they got to Utah, they were subjected to intense socialization and fellowshipping, as we would call it. And they became stalwarts, as you know, something like in 1850, something like 60% of all the residents of Utah were foreign-born. And let's see, I think Jean maybe be next.
Do you have any sense of why there is such resistance to local area developing their own culture, their own writing, their own theology, that? It seems like such a strange phenomenon. I heard a church editor complain about how his main problem was he had to make everything suitable for the whole church, and there's only an obvious solution to that problem. People do their own thing. Is there any change in that
attitude? It seems to be getting worse. Well, when I read, I've got in my article in here, I've cited a couple of things out of the Ensign from general authorities, which make it seem to me that general authorities understand this problem in principle, but understanding it operationally is difficult. We're all aware, if you look at the history of other world religions, Catholicism, Islam, they have all had to struggle with the process called syncretism. You know, how do you keep any kind of purity and integrity to the original religion when you start letting people make these local adaptations? We're only just now beginning to face that to any extent, and I think that the presiding brethren, knowing about this problem as they do, are very reluctant to give up control. So that's part of it. But another part of it is, I think, the reason in turn for a lot of the reluctance to give up control is that they haven't really made up their minds yet, and so we can't very well make up our minds, what really counts as something that you can't allow to be compromised or attenuated as basic gospel core. That is still up for grabs. And until that's resolved, I don't think we can resolve the next problem of autonomy, local autonomy. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. That was tongue in cheek. I was poking fun at myself as much as them. And I do need to say that these brethren and sisters, and there are women that work in this too up there. These, not many, but there are some. These brethren and sisters in that research operation have been unbelievably circumspect about what they will let out and will not let out. I'll tell you, some of them are really good friends of mine, but I need to get some stuff for this issue that only they had, and I couldn't get it. I mean, I tried everything. So they know very well, you know, as Perry Cunningham told me, if the presiding brethren ever get something from somewhere else before they get it from us. That is, if they get some of our data from somebody else before they get it from us, you know, we're going to be fired. And they've taken a lesson from what happened to the Leonard Arrington history operation. They don't want a replication of that. So now they're good guys. They'll do things like, three or four of these essays in here, I ran by them, and I said, not going to ask you to approve it or disapprove it, but read these and tell me if you see any glaring errors that I ought to worry about. And that's as much as they would do.
Retention-wise, also? Yeah.
I'm not so sure about the retention part, but I will say that at least as far as the conversion part goes, they outdo us. And not by a lot, but they outdo us. I would say that both of those groups probably convert something like 20% more than we do in the same period of time.
Okay. One more question, and I think we'll have to disperse.
Okay, I think you had a note of that. Right, as I said to Gene a minute ago, the only success is that it's understood in principle, but I don't think there's been much success in laying it out. I do cite a document here in my concluding essay in which an attempt has been made to do that.
An official attempt.
What success have we had so far in carving out this core of minimal doctrine? Yeah.
I'd like to thank Brother Moss very much for his contribution.
Thank you.